are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, June 13th, 2019. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael/Sam Thursday. And this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Senator Bernie Sanders joined Sam yesterday in a pre-recorded interview. They talked about completing the New Deal, why democratic socialism is the way to defeat oligarchy, and the ways in which he stands out that are so clear in the Democratic field. Then, joining me, Andrew Rice, staff writer at New York Magazine. When you're going to gut an island with austerity, you actually need managers, bureaucrats, to fill in the details. And that's why McKinsey is in Puerto Rico, carving up the place. It's a very disturbing report. Talk about that and the McKinsey way, colonial status of Puerto Rico. Then, of course, we'll get back to Sanders' defense of the democratic socialist tradition in America. Donald Trump says he still welcomes outside info from other countries. I mean, I guess those are the new playing field. I don't know. Facebook is worried about Mark Zuckerberg's privacy. Explosions reported on two tankers in the Gulf of Oman as Turkey embarks on a major arms sales purchase from Russia. There is going to be a hearing on reparations in the House next week. And the murderer of three Muslims, Craig Stephen Hicks, pleads guilty and is sentenced to life in prison. House Democrats launch an investigation on Jewel as Illinois' governor signs legislation protecting abortion rights. And Bernie Sanders has called for the immediate release of political prisoner Lula da Silva, as yet more drops from that story coming out in Brazil, now implicating at least one member of the Brazilian Supreme Court, potentially, as another member of the Brazilian Supreme Court says Lula must go free now. Peace process undermined in Yemen and might be heading towards elections in Israel. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. So what we're going to do is I have to tell you about something important. And then we're going to get to Sam's conversation. He recorded, I would say, what it was about 5 o'clock yesterday with Senator Sanders. So this is fresh. This is hot off the presses, obviously worth watching. And we'll be right back. But first, I want to tell you that today's show is in part sponsored by Skillshare. And if anyone who goes to skl.sh/majorityreport4, that's the number 4, is going to get 2 whole months of totally free access to Skillshare's entire library of super quality online courses and tutorials. Skillshare is a vibrant online learning community that offers courses on everything from design to video editing, photography, business, technology, cooking, meditation, and everything in between. There's a Skillshare course for everyone. You'll have no problem finding the courses that will be useful to both your personal and professional life. Whether you want to sharpen your skills with something you already love doing or you want to learn something totally new, Skillshare has you covered. They have courses for entrepreneurs, courses on computer coding, web development, personal nutrition, learning new languages, Photoshop, you name it. I need to build up my confidence as a language learner, but I have definitely been starting to explore the Portuguese section of this website. Definitely pretty relevant for me. And then, you know, there's also like super ambitious ones. Like, I mean, there was a time where you could say like Spanish, Arabic, and Mandarin. And then, of course, I mean, learning any language would be a great skill set. But there was like, you know, in the world as it is, learning those three languages, you know, you're covering a lot of really important bases there. So I'm starting to explore Portuguese, and I want to see if I gain some confidence. I want to see if I could at least develop a little bit of a skill set in Portuguese, and then maybe after that, something like Mandarin. We'll see. Just think, you can get 2 entire months of free access to every single course offered by Skillshare by going to skl.sh/majorityreport4. Just think of everything you'll have at your fingertips for 2 whole months. That's skl.sh/majorityreport4. And we've put a link underneath this video if you're watching on YouTube. All right, folks, we're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back with Sam's interview with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Sam, this is Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator. Thank you so much for doing this.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's jump right in. I saw your speech this afternoon. I enjoyed it. I got to say, I was struck by the disparity between your speech and comments that I saw former Vice President Biden make this week. You spoke quite a bit about movements that are endangering America. And the Vice President said that it was basically one man. He also said that he was the solution for that one man problem. What is your solution? Tell us what the movement that you think is threatening America, and what is your solution? I'm curious as to the disparity there.
Well, it's not only, sadly enough, an American effort. It is global. And that is, we're looking at a merger of oligarchy, which systems around the world which are controlled by extraordinarily wealthy billionaires, and authoritarianism. And that's kind of what's going on in this country. And what people like Trump and other people around the world do is to retain power, is they try to divide their people up by appealing to the most basest instincts, and focus the anger of the people on minorities, whether they are religious minorities, whether they are immigrants, whether they are part of the LGBT community, or people who have a different religion than the majority. But the point that I made today is that as a nation, we have got to recognize that the best way to defeat oligarchy and the best way to defeat authoritarianism is to bring people together around a progressive agenda, an agenda which guarantees economic rights as human rights. And the point that I made is that way back in 1944, in a not well-publicized State of the Union speech, Franklin Roosevelt said something very profound. He said, you know what? We have a Bill of Rights in this country that protects our political rights, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, etc. But we do not have anything that protects our economic rights, human rights. So you can, you can march and you can protest, but there is no guarantee that you can have a job that pays you a living wage. You can have any religion you want, but there is no guarantee that when you get sick, you're going to have the resources to go to a doctor, or if you're an elderly person, afford the prescription drugs that you need to stay alive. So the theme of today is that economic rights must be considered as human rights, and that is the need to continue what Roosevelt began some 80 years ago.
So I'm curious as to how it could be that there is this type of disparity in perception of the problem. I mean, that having gone through the past 8 years prior to Donald Trump and frankly the decades before that as well, that people can have such radically different vision of what the problem is, the scale of it, the structure of it.
Right. Well, I think that has a lot to do with media, frankly, in this country, which is owned by large corporations. And, I'm not one like Donald Trump who believes that there's fake news out there or the media is the enemy of the people. That's nonsense, of course, and dangerous. But what I think is that for a variety of reasons, media does not recognize the reality of what's going on in this country today. And we have got to do that. And that means it's not just 40 million people living in poverty. It's not just the 500,000 people tonight sleeping out on the streets. That's the worst case scenario. It is half of this country living paycheck to paycheck. It is tens of millions of people who cannot afford to go to the doctor when they are sick. It is one out of five people not being able to afford the prescription drugs that their doctors prescribe. It's kids not being able to afford to go to college or leaving school with outrageous levels of student debt. It is the crisis of climate change and what it will do to our country and the rest of the world unless we deal with it. So, you know, I think what I am trying to do is to say, look, these are the real, real problems facing ordinary Americans. And unless we have the courage to take on Wall Street, to take on the insurance companies and the drug companies and the military industrial complex and the fossil fuel industry, unless we have the courage to do that, we are not going to make the kind of progress that we need to.
So in your speech, you enumerated the 21st century economic bill of rights, like you'd mentioned earlier. And so you have these, and you'll be rolling out these proposals. You'll have these plans that go towards establishing these rights and these material benefits for people. What happens if say Joe Biden is wrong, that the Republicans do not revert to some type of mean, as it were? I'm not sure what that mean was, but what happens if we have a President Sanders and you have these plans and these proposals, which sound great? Is there a meta plan, a strategy? How do these things go forward if the Republicans?
Very good. Sam, that's absolutely right question. And look, this is what I believe, and this is, I think, what differentiates me a bit from other candidates. And this is what I believe. You know, I think if you look at the history of real change in this country, take a deep breath and think about, all right, what are the, and I'm not talking about superficial changes, modest changes, but about real changes. Think about it. We're talking about, say, 120, 130 years ago, where workers had to engage in enormous struggle for the right to have collective bargaining and to form trade unions and to end child labor. Took massive amounts of grassroots organizing and struggle to make that happen. You look at the civil rights movement and understand that real change never takes place from the top on down. It wasn't just Lyndon Johnson signing the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act. It was millions of people, African-Americans and their allies, who said, you know what, we're going to end segregation in this country. All people have the right to vote regardless of the color of their skin. You look at the women's movement. You know, as we talk 100 years ago today, women did not have the right to vote. How did that change come about? Come about because you had some great guys, men in the Congress? Well, there were some. But that struggle basically was won because women and their male allies took to the streets. Some of them died. Some of these women gave up their lives in the struggle. If you look at the gay rights revolution that's taken place in this country over the last 40 years. Think about Stonewall 50 years ago. It is people with incredible courage who took to the streets, who withstood humiliation and physical attacks to say, you know what, in this country, people should have the right to love whoever they want, regardless of their gender. The environmental movement, the same. So here is the point. Every idea that I am talking about, and that is the need for health care for all, the need to have jobs that pay people a living wage and raising that minimum wage to at least $15 an hour, the need to cut prescription drug costs in half, the need for affordable housing, the need for a clean environment, the need to make sure that companies like Amazon, which made $11 billion in profits last year, don't get away with not paying a nickel in federal income tax. All of these ideas are supported by the American people. But they are not going to be, we're not going to see the changes that we need unless there is a political revolution, unless ordinary people get involved in the political process in a way that we have never seen before. And the way we defeat Trump, the way we defeat authoritarianism, the way we defeat oligarchy is when working people and young people and all of us begin to stand up and to fight back.
Senator, as I hear you say that, I think I've probably the first time I interviewed you was maybe close to 15 years ago on Air America. And I can't help but think as you list those things of the different movements that have taken place in this country to make change. I wonder because, for years, I think I perceived you as being very much sort of a conscience of the country. And I wonder if you have felt that your role has changed in some way, because as you make that list of things that you're talking about, it just strikes me that I know that you were involved in those fights. You don't reference yourself in those. And I wonder if in some way the past several years, that during the course of the 2015-2016 election, you perceived your role as not just being someone who could remind the country of these things, but in some more active way, and in a way sort of returning to your roots.
Well, look, I don't see the separation, Sam. What I see is that if we're going to defeat authoritarianism, one of the points that I made this afternoon, it's not just that what FDR did was good public policy and standing up and improving the lives of working people. You know what else he did? All over Europe, countries went fascist, or in Germany, Nazi. And what he was able to do is tell the working people of this country in a very difficult moment that government was there for them, that in America, the president of the United States would stand for them. So we're looking at not just good public policy, we're looking at good politics. We're saying the working people today are working two or three jobs. You know what? That doesn't have to be the case. People who have no health care, get involved in the political process, get a government that's going to elect, that's going to represent working people, and we can bring about change. And in doing that, we can fend off the authoritarianism, the oligarchy that Trump represents. So what I'm talking about here is my belief, recent polling has suggested that I can beat Trump in this country. Some of the polls out there have me beating them by a double-digit number, and especially in battleground states like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. So I think in this case, to answer your question, good policy, standing up with working people is good politics as well.
Do you think that with your sort of, the more recognition and more, in many respects, political power that you've developed has led you to more opportunities to put that to use? I mean, I'm thinking about things like your work with getting Amazon to raise their wages, going to the Walmart meeting, the War Powers Act with Yemen. Right. I mean, these are all things. These were intractable issues in some respects, and you have been able to pry them loose
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that is correct. And, I think in the case of Disney, for example, we heard from Disney workers who are marching around Disneyland in Anaheim, California, in Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck outfits, and they were making 10, 11 bucks an hour. And we stood with those workers and we forced Disney, frankly, pay their workers 15 bucks an hour. And Amazon, the same thing. They were paying workers 10, 11, 12 bucks an hour. We heard from these Amazon workers. We used our social media. We did everything we could. And Jeff Bezos and Amazon said, okay, we'll pay their workers 15 bucks an hour. And as you indicated, I've been working with the Fight for 15 people. At McDonald's, we were just in Iowa the other day marching. There's some incredibly brave people who just went on strike. They left their jobs at McDonald's, and they said, you know what, we can't make it on 10, 11 bucks an hour. We need a living wage. And I went to the Walmart Board of Directors. We'll see what happens there. But, we're going to continue our effort to tell the wealthiest family in this country, the Walton family, who owns Walmart, that they cannot pay their workers starvation wages.
How much of your work on the War Powers Act in regards to Yemen and frankly calling with Representative Ro Khanna for the freedom of Lula from imprisonment is tied into this sort of movement that you see that is rising across the globe.
Right. I mean, you know, look, one of the things that we have managed to do, for example, is to raise the issue of Yemen, which is an unbelievable and horrific human tragedy. I mean, the UN estimates that if we don't stop this war and get humanitarian aid in, there hundreds of thousands of people will be dead by the end of this year, and that millions could die of famine if we do not end the war in years to come. And I was very proud to work with Roe, to work with some conservative Republicans, frankly, in the Senate, to say that the president does not have the authority, does not have the constitutional right to get the United States involved in that war, and we won it. For the first time in 45 years, we used the War Powers Act for a majority vote in the House and the Senate. Not surprisingly, of course, Trump vetoed it. We weren't able to overcome the veto. But that was a major step forward in getting the Congress to reclaim its constitutional responsibilities over warmaking, which has essentially been taken over by presidents for many years.
Lastly, Senator, I know you're busy here. What do you think is the greatest challenge that your campaign is facing right now? I mean, what do you feel that you need to achieve, particularly leading up over the next couple of months before Iowa, but into the campaign?
Well, you know, we have, I think, in an unprecedented way, Sam, we have over 1 million people in every congressional district in the United States of America signed up to volunteer and work on this campaign. And it ain't easy. And I think to answer your question, the challenge that we face is how we help build this unprecedented grassroots movement, which not only will we need to win the election and to defeat Trump, but also to transform this country. And that's what we're wrestling with right now. And it ain't easy. It really is not. But making that million plus people into an effective fighting machine is, I think, the key challenge that we face right now.
And that's one that, I mean, are you contemplating too, like how you keep that machine to function in the event that you win, or frankly, even in the event that
you
lose?
Absolutely. The answer is absolutely yes. I mean, that ties into what I believe is the political revolution. All right, I think I got to get off
yes.
right now.
Senator Sanders, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Right, bye-bye.
Yes, that's exactly right, but I got to go. Got to run.
Jesus Christ, how much that Bernie Sanders really is the perpetual creator of shame for anybody who's tired in their 20s and 30s. Yeah. It's just like,
seriously.
I have to go end a war, end a genocide in Yemen, organize a Walmart, McDonald's workers, run a presidential campaign, run a media studio, which is
free
essentially
a political prisoner.
Free a political prisoner, and then do like 50 hits. I mean, my God. Maybe that's the only advantage of MSNBC's disgraceful treatment of him and his campaign is that he has a couple of less obligations. But yes, I will obviously we'll talk more about that speech in the second part of the show. But for now, we're going to take a brief break and we're going to go speak with Andrew Rice. He's a reporter for New York Magazine. The piece is The McKinsey Way to Save an Island.
But the damage is too severe.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Andrew Rice. He's a contributing editor at New York Magazine. Andrew, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks.
So you wrote this piece, The McKinsey Way to Save an Island. I mean, you know, it's no secret if you know, the people watching and listening know the politics of this show, that there's a lot of criticism of corporate and U.S. conduct in Puerto Rico. And I think that this reporting does really fit into this. But before we get there, I mean, can you explain the two different trajectories of this story, at least as I was able to read it? One is, what is McKinsey as a consultancy? What does McKinsey do in the private and public sector?
Wow. Well, I mean, that's like that. People have written books on that subject,
right.
And it's a little hard to sum up because, frankly, McKinsey does so many things. Like McKinsey does everything from, you know, if you're looking to, like, you know, work on your supply chain for your wind turbine company, you know, you bring in McKinsey to talk with them about that. If you're a catastrophically in debt principality of the United States that needs consulting services on how to slash your government services, they also do that. Like they do almost everything that a client might ask them to do. The one unifying thing is that they charge quite a bit for it.
Right. And so when we talk about the predicament that Puerto Rico is in, it seems to me that it's really important to sort of establish and, you know, the sort of bigger context for it, which is that there isn't, you know, there is this, I mean, I would say it's, you know, obviously a colonial status, but there's a lot of limits in terms of what Puerto Rico can and can't do in terms of its own macroeconomic policy. And recently, there's been, for a variety of reasons, including, of course, exacerbated by Hurricane Maria, this demand from capital, from hedge funds, basically, to start to sort of slash to service Puerto Rico's debt. But what is the sort of legal, political mechanisms around Puerto Rico? Like, I think just in sort of broadly, like spelling out, like, what is the control board? What is the sort of current legal status? How did Puerto Rico kind of get into the situation of needing or supposedly needing the services of a company like McKinsey? What's that sort of part of the story?
Well, so the story starts with Christopher Columbus.
right.
But to skip ahead a few centuries, I mean, basically, you know, Puerto Rico's status is as you say, a sort of quasi-colonial status. They would probably, a lot of people in Puerto Rico would delete the quasi part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have non-voting representation in Congress, and so therefore they're largely dependent on members of Congress, oftentimes people from the Puerto Rican diaspora, who to represent their interests in Washington. So they have a local elected government, a governor, a legislature, and so on that has governing authority within the island, just like any state government does. The only difference is that they, you know, of course, they don't have any electoral votes, but also they don't have the kind of constitutional protections that a U.S. state has in terms of, you know, it's ultimately kind of it exists in a kind of it's self-government exists as a kind of you know, because the federal government decrees it so, right? So what ended up happening was over many, many years, Puerto Rico borrowed lots and lots of money to fund their government and to fund services. Oftentimes, you know, services that say, for instance, like a Medicaid program that they have, they don't get as generous treatment from Medicaid as a U.S. state would. So they were kind of having to make up the gap on something like that out of their own tax revenues. Consequently, ended up running up these gigantic debts, largely, you know, kind of encouraged and underwritten by financial institutions that were more than happy to issue this debt because of another quirk of its territorial status. It has a special tax exemption, and it was very, it was a very kind of attractive investment for a lot of mutual funds.
For holding bonds, is that right? For holding bonds?
That's right, yes.
Okay. So, can you explain that a little bit? Yeah.
Sure. So because Puerto Rico, essentially, it's quite complicated, but essentially because of Puerto Rico, the fact that they're not a state, their municipal bonds or their state bonds would be, you know, are not subject to state taxation in the same way, or federal taxation in the same way. They're what's known as triple tax exempt, and consequently, you know, they were just considered to be this very, very, ironically, they were considered to be this very, very safe investment, this very kind of staid, you know, stable investment that got a kind of favorable tax treatment. And so therefore, a lot of, you know, Vanguard or, you know, just just any kind of mutual fund that you can think of would have probably some portfolio of Puerto Rican bonds. Now, of course, what happened was is that, as often happens, is that, you know, Goldman Sachs and other financial institutions came in and said, you know, hey, we could, like, you've got a pretty good thing here. There's a market for this. Like, let's kind of come up with some more creative ways to securitize your government revenues. Why don't we carve out the sales tax revenue, turn that into a separate kind of bond? What if we carve out this or that other rum bonds? There's actually bonds that are tied specifically to revenues from rum. So fast forward about 20 years of doing this, all of a sudden, you know, without anybody really kind of keeping track of it within Puerto Rico, or being well publicized within Puerto Rico, all of a sudden it turns out, wait, hold on, we've got $74 billion in debt, and, you know, we're far poorer than any U.S. state. There's no way we can possibly pay this back. So Puerto Rico says, sorry, we can't pay this back. We're going to have to go bankrupt. And there's a problem, you know, there's a problem there, because basically, unlike Detroit, unlike New York City in the 1970s, Puerto Rico had no legal mechanism to declare bankruptcy. In fact, it was specifically left out of the federal bankruptcy code chapter that governs municipal bankruptcy.
And because of its colonial status. I mean, that's how they could do that. Is that correct?
So in the big picture, yes, because of its colonial status. In the little picture, like, no one actually seems to – I've asked many people, including many people who are not sympathetic to, you know, the Reagan administration that was, like, was the administration in office at the time this bankruptcy thing happened. Like, no one actually seems to know the actual reason why Puerto Rico was left out. It was specifically exempted from this in the 1980s. Presumably there was some reason why, but it's one of those kind of – legislative, you know, kind of small print in some kind of huge omnibus law sort of things that nobody can quite figure out why it happened. But yes. Suffice it to say, if Puerto Rico had congressional representation, it probably wouldn't have happened to them.
Right.
Anyway, you know, a generation later, it becomes an issue. And so Congress has to pass a new law, specifically to allow Puerto Rico to declare bankruptcy.
What year is this? Just in terms of the timeline?
This is in 2016.
Okay,
so the tail end of the Obama administration.
Okay.
So Obama is on the way out. Treasury, the Department of Treasury, his Department of Treasury is saying, oh God, we got to do something about Puerto Rico. Like, you know, we got to figure out some way to help them work out this debt, because these hedge funds, basically what had happened is Vanguard and all the mutual funds that I mentioned before that held all those Puerto Rican bonds, well, as soon as things got risky, they were like, we're out of here. They sold their stuff, and they sold it largely to distressed debt hedge funds, whose specialty is, as your listeners probably know, they do this often in various different scenarios, buying up debt and in troubled companies or troubled countries or troubled, you know, anything, and basically trying to squeeze a little bit of blood from that stone, and make a sort of marginal profit over whatever it is that they sold that they bought the bonds for at some very depressed price. And you know, so all these hedge funds are in there, and their whole business model is basically to kind of turn the screws on the Puerto Rican government. So they were saying things like, and they were getting some Republican congressional support from the Freedom Caucus and others. They're saying things like, you know, let's start closing down, you know, Puerto Rican government ministries and let's do these extraordinarily draconian cuts, you know, cutting pensions for poor Puerto Rican former government servants and so on, in order to pay back this debt service. And they were basically saying, you have no recourse under federal law. You're specifically exempted from bankruptcy. So, you know, pay up. You have to do it. So Obama administration, Congress, including, you know, to his credit, you know, Paul Ryan, you know, came to the conclusion, and some other Republicans in Congress and the congressional leadership came to the conclusion that, you know, no, it's not going to be tenable for us to just for the hedge funds to just completely turn Puerto Rico into a debtor state. So they created this law. It's called PROMESA. PROMESA allowed Puerto Rico to declare bankruptcy, to basically seek protection from bankruptcy court, which means that they don't have to pay debt service while they're in this bankruptcy proceeding. And the kind of bargain there, the rub for the Puerto Rican government was they had to accept this federal oversight board called the Oversight Board. In Puerto Rico, it's often called La Junta. The junta came in, and I mean, I think all the kind of dictatorial overtones are intended. The yes. junta came in. It's a federally appointed group of folks, equally Republican and Democrat. Not equally. They're 4-3 Republican, I believe. And they came in, and they were charged with trying to work out this $73 billion debt problem. And so they came in, they were experts. Many of them are experts on this, that, and the other thing, but, you know, it's a gigantic problem. They didn't have a lot of people. They didn't want to hire a big staff. So what they did is they said, you know, we're going to hire these guys at McKinsey to come in and tell us how to work out the debt, but also how to try to make Puerto Rico's government finances sustainable. And that's where really my story, you know, begins, with McKinsey's efforts to do that, which have included a lot of really draconian cuts.
Yeah, so I want to get right to those McKinsey cuts and also, you know, credible charges of conflict of interest on the part of McKinsey as well. But so, I mean, you know, this is just my sort of editorial, but I mean, is it fair to say that, okay, we have this larger historical colonial context, and there's a lot of other, you know, rules that we can't get into that affect Puerto Rico's ability to generate its economy. There's a lot of very, you know, weird and unjust taxes that apply specifically to Puerto Rico, and things like importation and so on. There's a shipping regulator. There's a shipping tax whose name I'm forgetting at the moment, but is very important. So you get to this position where Puerto Rico's sort of bled out to begin with. Then the debt crisis hits. There's the really radical extreme notion of just, you know, going in and utterly devastating Puerto Rico. But sort of cooler heads prevail, and it's like, well, instead of just total savagery, we'll have like a kind of slow bleed out. And you know, some basic necessary protections, like you're in bankruptcy, you don't have to service your debt at the moment, but we'll have this oversight board, we'll bring in McKinsey, and we'll do, you know, in fact, very vicious cuts, but in a more kind of systemic, slower way than what people like the Freedom Caucus were proposing. And all along the way, you know, none of the real questions about the status of Puerto Rico, democracy in Puerto Rico. And then, of course, with Trump, you add this dimension of, you know, playing to his own base and his own just sort of, you know, utter disrespect for the Puerto Rican people, you know, throwing paper towels at them like he's shooting baskets and so on. And that brings us to where we are. So what, yeah, I mean, in this piece, you know, you do a very good job. You're very fairly representing the McKinsey point man on the ground for this stuff and sort of his, you know, I will say, highly stereotypical kind of management speak about innovation and all of these, you know, red flag words. But, you know, what are they actually doing in terms of cuts? Like, what does this, behind all the sort of jargon, what does this actually look like?
I mean, it's a pretty thoroughgoing, complete revamping or gutting, depending on your point of view of it, of the entire Puerto Rican public sector. So let's start with like the power authority, PREPA, which was gained a lot of notoriety after all of this started because, you know, they were unable to restore power to the island for, you know, a year, basically. PREPA is in the course of being privatized and sold off to, you know, private entities. You know, there's similar stuff is going on with other government parastatals. There's thoroughgoing cuts throughout the government, and hundreds of schools are being closed. Now, to be fair to McKinsey and to the Oversight Board, some of that the school closures were in the works prior even to PROMESA. There's an ongoing systemic problem with population loss in Puerto Rico, which led to many schools being underpopulated. So there's maybe actually an educational policy justification for doing it, but nonetheless, it's been, you know, implemented in a very painful way that's caused a lot of controversy, and the junta has been sort of like largely taking the blame for it. There's Puerto Rican pensioners are taking significant haircuts, sort of on average of about 10% on their pensions, which weren't that big to begin with. You just go through, you know, and if you want to really get into the weeds, which is actually where McKinsey operates, right?
Yep.
You know, they operate in the deep, impenetrable, you know, kind of numbers that are actually where the real power is, right? You know, there's a lot of stuff going on there. You know, like it's too complicated for me to completely understand, I think, and second of all for us to discuss in the context of this. But like suffice it to say that like there's a lot of stuff happening on spreadsheets and with computers that ends up having, you know, really kind of noticeable effects on Puerto Rican life. Just to take, you know, one example, our collaborators that we were working with on this story, you know, a Puerto Rican investigative news website, talked with the head of the Department of Public Safety, who was complaining that, you know, they're having this catastrophic crime wave, in part because of the police department has lost so many officers, and the head of the Department of Public Safety was complaining that, you know, because of the Oversight Board, he wasn't able to buy bullets,
right.
Which kind of seems like a very basic thing that the police probably need.
Well, I want to get to, you know, because I do. There's a few other things I want to cover in the last, you know, couple of minutes we have, but I do, in the end, I want to loop back to a philosophical question that actually, and maybe I should just, I'll set that aside, but I think it's actually, there's two quotes that are really important to center. But before we get there, the other major part of the story is that I would say, as I said, you know, a very credible allegation about a conflict of interest in McKinsey in terms of their work in Puerto Rico. And I would be very interested too, because as you also note in the article, they're doing this sort of stuff in a lot of places across the Caribbean. But what specifically is the charge of a conflict of interest between McKinsey's consulting work and their own financial interests as a broader, you know, global consultancy, which again, you know, as you said, they work everywhere. This is, they're involved with everything from Trump administration immigration policy to Mohammed bin Salman's plans for Saudi Arabia. So what's the, what is it?
So the issue is basically this, that McKinsey has something called the McKinsey Investment Office. It started in the 1980s, supposedly to kind of manage retirement funds for McKinsey. It's grown into like about a $12 billion fund, and they operate internally. They operate some hedge funds that are, you know, have, you know, $1 billion or more in assets under management. They claim that there's a big Chinese wall where, you know, that the hedge fund people don't know anything about what the consultants are doing. There's a lot of questions about that. And in part, you know, even if it is completely being done, if there is complete sort of informational compartmentalization, what it really brings to the fore is the fact that, you know, McKinsey doesn't disclose anything about who it's working for, and it really doesn't disclose anything about who it's investing in. So the only way that you can really, you know, assure yourself that McKinsey isn't doing things that benefit McKinsey is to take McKinsey's word for it. And McKinsey's basic position on this is like, of course we wouldn't do this because we're McKinsey. you know,
right.
they have this kind of, you know, almost sort of aristocratic attitude about it, that they're the foremost management consulting firm in the world, and therefore, you know, and they have this kind of unimpeachable reputation, and therefore, you know, they can do things differently than other people do. For instance, in bankruptcy court, you're supposed to disclose everything that you're, you know, all your investments. If you're a lawyer working in bankruptcy court or a bankruptcy advisor, you're supposed to say, I'm invested in X, Y, and Z, and here are my other clients. McKinsey wasn't doing that. They ran into a bunch of trouble. It's kind of complicated. But anyway, suffice it to say, it became a big controversy. They weren't disclosing things that looked like they could be conflicts of interest.
In terms of benefiting from austerity packages in Puerto Rico. Just, I mean, you don't need to spell more of it out, but that their work in Puerto Rico could be implicating some of their investments.
It was far broader than just Puerto Rico. But
sure.
what happened when they started being examined a little more closely is it turned out that, lo and behold, the hedge fund that McKinsey operates had a substantial investment in Puerto Rican government bonds, distressed government bonds,
that just happened to be
part of a settlement that was quite a generous settlement from the government. These bondholders got a lot of money back, and, you know, every cent that the bondholders get back in these bankruptcy settlements is, you know, it's money that's not going to the Puerto Rican government. It's money that they're paying out the door to hedge funds. So this became quite controversial. It was, you know, it was investigated by the oversight board. I should say the oversight board's own internal investigation found that there's no conflict of interest. But you can understand how people in Puerto Rico weren't necessarily taking that at face value.
I can understand how I'm not taking that at face value. So in the last couple what it brings up is that
the oversight board is almost completely dependent on McKinsey for everything.
It's right.
Like,
I mean,
they're doing everything, right?
Well,
so
I mean, that's
they couldn't kick them out.
Yeah, and I mean, not to interrupt, but I mean, look, obviously, again, of course, I don't believe it, just don't believe it, full stop. But frankly, even if you took a more sort of moderate or modest position on it, you could just say, even if it was theoretically clean, under the current arrangement, you could never demonstrate that just definitionally because of the level of interdependence here. And so
yes,
I think that, yeah.
That's yeah, absolutely right.
Right. And that brings me to the last couple of minutes, because I want to touch on, because you really do a great job too in this of also highlighting some philosophical themes. And so to me, you know, yes, there's one element that a lot of firms and a lot of bureaucracies and companies like, you know, McKinsey, they can get away with doing a lot of damage by overcomplexifying things. And, you know, sure, there's some operations, there's some things, there's some technical capacities that are complex. But on the other hand, I think that there's like, you know, there is the other end of it, which is that it actually is pretty simple. Do you have bullets or not? Do you have, you know, school books or not, is actually not terribly complicated. And you know, I think a lot of this actually, we learned a lot of this from the Wall Street meltdown, you know, of Wall Street banks. Oh, you couldn't possibly understand all these mechanisms. Well, maybe not in the terms of, you know, sitting in front of the computer and generating the algorithms, but certainly we can all understand enough to know the systemic risk you're posing to the global economy. So I want to just give you two quotes to me that just sort of highlight that. So one, you quote from a very good piece that was published in Current Affairs by a young McKinsey consultant who wrote this piece. They wrote the piece. They quit the company in disgust because they were disgusted by McKinsey's work with the Trump administration's immigration policy. And this person, I guess apparently is a he, even though it's anonymous, but we know the person's gender.
It's a guy, I think it's fair to say.
McKinsey is capitalism distilled. Its advocacy of the primacy of the market has made governments more like businesses and businesses more like vampires, end quote. That seems to me, again, it's polemical, but that sounds like you could strip the polemic indefinitely. I don't think anybody would disagree with the assertion that that's what they're doing, making it run more like a quote-unquote business. Then we go to the gentleman who's in charge of McKinsey in Puerto Rico telling you, again, and this is the most sort of Howard Schultzian kind of peak line imaginable, set aside politics, set aside policy, set aside all of that. There was a true management crisis that has come to a head because of the debt. Isn't that sort of like the distillation of not only the fact that, you know, when you adopt that rhetoric that always basically means that you're going to do policies that are, you know, not going to be good for, you know, working or middle class people, but that the McKinsey way of not acknowledging just precisely of where they are actually coming from, right or wrong. It's that we're just doing math versus we have a very clear ideology about how the world works, and we're using our quantitative skills to implement it, right or wrong.
Well, I mean, I would actually sort of take a slightly different view of it, mm-hmm. which is that I think that part of what's going on is that the McKinsey folks are having to deal with a really kind of jarring recalibration or shift in the way that their work is judged. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that until recently, the idea that private sector kind of management oriented solutions were the way to reinvent government, as Bill Clinton, you know, to use the Clintonian phrase, right? And Chelsea Clinton worked for McKinsey, right?
Yep.
That idea had sort of a broad, I think, bipartisan acceptance in Washington that this was the management efficiency was necessary, and that the kind of McKinsey-esque solutions, technocratic, private sector-oriented solutions to governance problems were kind of not only just like the way to go and the like most effective way to solve government problems, but also like that they were like considered to be apolitical. And I think the big thing that's changed and the thing that McKinsey is having a lot of trouble grappling with is the fact that, you know, there's now a whole movement in which people are saying, wait, no, your apolitical solution is in fact political, right?
Of course, right.
You're claiming that these are just sort of that we're just like we're just here the management consultants here to tell you how better to manage things. Like, you know, we'll leave the politics to the politicians. And a lot of, you know, I think a lot of people are basically rightly standing up and saying, no, wait, you don't get to claim that you're the only people, you're the only honest brokers here, and that your solutions, which, you know, that you claim are the right solutions, always happen to end up benefiting the same kind of cluster of interests in society. I think that there's been widespread questioning of that, and questioning of their motives, questioning their preconceptions, and questioning the effects of those preconceptions. And I think, you know, to the degree that I have sympathy for them, I do have a little sympathy for the fact that, like, these folks have gone through their entire lives and their entire careers basically being lauded for the way that they approach problems, and now all of a sudden it's being viewed in a different light, and they're suddenly having to kind of grapple with the possibility that what they consider to be the sort of broadly accepted conventional wisdom is not in fact being accepted by society anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that is, you know, psychologically disruptive for them.
They've got a lot of consolation.
Yeah, I was going to say
they can fall back on for sure. But
yes,
like, but yeah,
yes.
I mean, I find it to be, as a journalist, I find it to be an interesting
definitely.
An interesting phenomenon to explore, and I mean, I generally come from the point of view that, like, I mean, sure, there are people who are just outright bad actors, right? And you know, the McKinsey guy who went to go run Valeant Pharmaceuticals, you know, like, you know, even McKinsey people that I talked to were like, oh, that guy, you know, was bad news. But I think that there are a lot of people who are there who basically, you know, who are the hardest thing for them cognitively to, like, work out is that they think that they're the good guys, right? They think that they're coming in to Puerto Rico with, like, a set of solutions, and, like, you know, they think that they're the sort of, like, you know, management consulting ninjas who are, like, there to, like, you know, to kind of come in and solve this problem for this poor benighted island that hasn't had good management, you know, for generations. And let's face it, like, you know, they haven't had great management for generations. there's some truth in what McKinsey's saying, and I think most Puerto Ricans would agree with it. But like, you know, I think that the problem is just, like, you know, they expected to be greeted as liberators, right? And they weren't.
I think that, I mean, the last thing I'll say, I think that that's a very good analogy. And the other thing that just struck me, and again, you know, I think we even need to be very aware when we talk about mismanagement and so on, just because it's become such a crutch of, you know, of course, I don't think, you know, the sort of parties that have governed Puerto Rico have certainly not distinguished themselves. But again, there's such a context that this exists inside, that the idea of, you know, to me, it's almost analogous to, how did we get a conversation in this country for a really long period of time where it was like, you know, it's the teacher's fault, right? And I'm not even talking like, yes, I support teachers' unions and so on, of course. But of course, I mean, undoubtedly, there's individually bad and underperforming teachers. That's sort of definitional in any profession. The idea that somebody making, you know, 50 grand a year working like 12, you know, 10, 12-hour days is great or terrible, the deciding factor in a national education system, is delusional. So, you know, to me, it's like, where is the starting point of how we talk about something like how Puerto Rico's managed? And when you say greeted as liberators, it also struck me how, and, you know, just your final thoughts on this, that you really spend a lot of time, again, just, you know, and not questioning their motives or anything like that, but just the idea that you have some 24-year-old or something that just graduated from Yale or Columbia coming in and rejiggering, you know, the tourism industry. It struck me kind of as analogous to some of the problems people identified on, you know, police going into neighborhoods that they have nothing to do with, they don't live by. And again, sort of in a similar analogy, you can almost strip aside the individual motivations of a particular police officer and just say there's a structural problem here. And the idea that you're having people who have no real connection to a place come in and make drastic decisions about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, look, and to be fair, I think, you know, Bertil Chapuis, the individual that I spent the most time with on this story, you know, I think he'd be the first person to say, like, you know, part of this is structural, and there's a structural political problem here that, and the issue is like blaming McKinsey in a way is like also like not all that, in some ways is not also not all that constructive. There is a legal structure set up that systematically screws over Puerto Rico.
Yep.
And so, you know, McKinsey is just one portion of that, but they're far from the only one, you know? And I think that, you know, blaming one set of people or one company or one government is like, is a lot easier than taking a hard look and saying like, you know, why is it that the United States basically owns an island and doesn't give it any legal representation, and also, you know, quite systematically starves it of the kind of tax support that that a U.S. state would have.
100%. It's a fascinating piece. Andrew Rice. The piece is "The McKinsey Way to Save an Island." It's in New York Magazine. Lot to learn. Andrew, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Take care. All right, folks. Lot to get to in the fun half. We're running a little bit behind, so let me just say majority.fm/become a member. You can click also on the homepage. It's very easy to do. Less than 40 cents a day. It's how this show does what it does, which I think, and I mean,
from, speaks for itself, baby.
It does. But I mean, really, I mean, from content like that to even like some important sort of corrective work on the Rubens and Crowders of the world, covering a lot of bases between all of us and obviously with Sam at the helm here. So support us, spread the word. Also, of course, very proud of and excited about TMBS. This Sunday, Illicit History and Primer of the Modern History of the Labour Party in the UK and the Leadership of Jeremy Corbyn with Don Foster of Jacobin and The Guardian. And of course, Glenn Greenwald was just on, and I'll be talking about these just incredible revelations on the process in Brazil. Patreon.com/TMBS. If you haven't yet, we've cracked, we're well over our first 50,000. We just crossed it last night. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Get a flavor of the very different sets of things that we cover there. But obviously, presumably, if you like this show, you'll, you know, very high likelihood you'll like TMBS. Matt, Literary Hangover.
Yeah, if you've been looking for the most recent Literary Hangover episode, it's probably because you're not a patron. That's the Such Were the Joys episode in my George Orwell series. So check that out.
And of course, you can check out The Antifada, History as a Weapon, and all the other content there as well. The Wu-Tang of the left-wing podcast universe. We'll see you in the fun half.
It seems that there's a much more negative view of fascism than communism.